Have you checked your media consumption lately? In the 20th century, we monitored our consumption of media through the hours spent in front of the television, the number of movies we saw, the number of newspaper articles and books read. The specific quality and type of content absorbed through those mediums didn't make many headlines, but the numbers did. As researchers and parents alike saw families spending astonishing amounts of time in front of the boob tube. The web has made research on media consumption astonishingly more difficult. You could be doing almost anything on the web, from the aforementioned TV watching, book and newspaper reading, to activities you might also do in real life, like shopping, gaming, and chatting with friends. And the web follows us almost everywhere now, in the form of smartphones and laptops, chasing after us like a puppy begging for attention. You might say that the web has integrated media consumption into our lives so seamlessly as to become almost indistinguishable from any other daily activity. Still, the quantity of information we're exposed to, and how we're exposed to it, can tell us a lot about how we engage with society. Russell Newman, a professor of media technology at the University of Michigan, has done quite a bit of research on this. He stopped by Radio Berkman to explain the evolution of how we interact with information.
There was a small group of researchers in Tokyo working for the phone company of all things who decided to measure how much information entered the average Japanese home back in the 1950s. And on a visit to this research institute in Tokyo, my mentor said, "My gosh, that's an important issue. How come nobody's ever done that?" And so he basically modeled his own research in the U.S. on this notion. You ignore pictures and you simply count the number of words that enter the average American household. And they used facsimile, newspapers, radio, television. Then he'd look at the average number of pages in a newspaper, count the number of words on the page, and look at the circulation figures and figure out how many words in total entered the average household. And then he would look at surveys and experiments about how many words somebody actually read. So he developed from 1960 to 1980 the number of words available and the number of words actually consumed. Given the dramatic changes of the new media and digital revolutions, my graduate students and I at the University of Michigan picked up where Ithia left off in 1980. Starting in 2005, just about everything starts to move in very dramatic ways to be flowing into the home via the web as more and more television and radio, et cetera, become internet-based. We have, from the period 1960 to 2005, the internet is sort of a competitor to the other media. You'd either do something on the internet or you'd sit down and read your newspaper or watch television. The issue that we addressed was to figure, well, this business of words, and when my mentor published his work, he published it in one of the most distinguished journals for scientists, the magazine Science. And he published data for the United States as a whole, which meant there were many trillions of words per year from 1960 to 1980, and it grew dramatically.
But this is the number of words available, not the number of words consumed.
Right.
Because you only watch one station at a time, generally.
You only watch one station at a time. Actually, that's not completely true, because in 1960, the number of television sets per household was 0.9. And when we finished in 2005, the average televisions per household was 3.6. So that meant that there were about 3.6 television channels on average, 1.1 newspapers, and if you look at the ratio again of the number of minutes it would take to read the entire newspaper to the number of minutes consumed, the ratio is 40 to 1, you'd calculate that this was actually a human-level choice. So as I present these materials, I ask my audience, what do you think the ratio of available minutes to be consumed was in 2005? And I hope that my audience is sort of speculating, well, it's going to be a lot more than 98 to 1. And the answer is 20,943 to 1. And my argument is that when you raise the level of available information to the average household to levels like that, you're no longer able to simply pick what you want because you know where it's located. The whole dynamic of how the individual comes to understand a world around them has shifted to one that simply requires a mechanical or intelligent or electronic interface. And the machine on the web is a search engine of some kind, and likely at this day and age to be Google. And in the level of television, it's increasingly a DVR or TiVo-like machine that watches television for you, and you influence it, and it suggests to you what you should watch.
So I'm confused about the 20,000 number. Given that I have the entire internet available to me, what does that 20,000 number represent?
You've asked a, I'm trying to describe this fairly extensive project briefly, so I skipped over something that I very much appreciate your drawing attention to. I have treated the internet as if it were like one channel at a time. And so I've simply described the internet as being available 24 hours a day, and many of the people active and engaged with portable devices basically have the internet available to them and are likely to turn to it just for a few seconds, but at any point in time from their mobile device or the laptop that's almost always with them, etc. So it's difficult. If you add that in, and it sort of throws everything out of kilter, let's say, how many pages does Google routinely monitor? And one estimate is 8.5 billion pages or web clusters or addresses. And one of the more recent published estimates of the total size of the web is 13.5 billion. So 20,000 kind of keeps us in the same metric. It's very clear if you take the diversity of the long tail that the web makes available.
That number's only going to go up, so it makes your case stronger. Your conclusion is that, therefore, in this new scale, we need machines. It's no longer a human, simply a human choice. Mm-hmm. Couldn't one say that, in fact, what we are getting are not machines but social ways of navigating, finding, searching?
You need something, because you can't just simply reach out and say, I know where the country music station is, I know where public radio is. The first thing that one thinks of is the search engine. It just sort of comes, and you sort of, that's sort of a machine. But you turn to your friends and say, through, it may be mediated through a Dig or Reddit, some kind of socially networked and digitally enhanced device. Or you could simply turn to the person next to you and say, geez, where would I find something that tells me how to get from here to where the coffee is? And so the dependence on friends, distant friends, and digitally enhanced electronic relationships to find what you want becomes de rigueur, required.
So one could portray this shift as being in the olden days, you know, like 5 years ago, the reduction of the amount of information was done off-premises, was filtered by others, and presented to you through a very limited number of TV stations and newspapers, which have filtered the world's news down to what fits into a daily paper or what fits into a daily broadcast. That now this decision is being distributed among the viewers, readers, the consumers of the information. Do you see effects on the power structures in the culture because of this?
I'm smiling. It's difficult to communicate, but not impossible to communicate a smile over an audio channel. I think it follows from what we've been describing and drawn from these data is a concern that, well, wait a minute, if I require some mechanical or institutional advice to tell me how to find what I want to find, should I be concerned about the biases or the interests of those that put themselves forward as the arbiter of what I should be paying attention to be important, just as we had been concerned about ownership and multiple voices and tried to regulate the one-way flow that preceded us? And I think those are very important and difficult concerns. The number, the various numbers that one sees are that less than 10% of those that would conduct a search using something like Google go to the second page. So that means that the decision of Google Inc. to put something on the first page based on a variety of mechanical and possibly non-mechanical or self-interested terms, in addition to the sponsored linkages, means that the power to move from the second or third or fourth page to the first page in a Google search in response to a term that people choose to use to search is extremely important and powerful in the flow of information and ideas in a society. So as those who use the term public sphere to think about our awareness, each of us, about the world around us and those that are like us, that have the same kind of identity, and those that are different from us, these issues of how the world is electronically mediated become very politically and culturally significant. One further thought on the flow of information to the American home is to think about the old days when what you knew about the world around you was determined by a bunch of guys with green eye shades, the editorial committee of the local newspaper that would put things on the front page. The character of the newspaper and the television broadcasting and use of the scarce spectrum meant that there was a one-way flow. Wouldn't it be nice if there was enough spectrum out there and enough printing or something that everybody who wanted to speak, not just those who owned the local newspaper, could speak as much and wouldn't have their remarks edited by the letters to the editor of the newspaper? And indeed, the internet really brings forth that prospect. When you can ask anything you want of the world, what do you ask? And the answer, one answer to that question is looking at what people put in search engines. And we have a parallel project, which is to try to say, what are the issues that are raised by various categories of public, political, and cultural? When you look at what's on the front page of the New York Times or in the CBS Evening News, and what are the prominent questions that reflect the attention of the public? If you look at a set of search queries, for better or worse, with some redacted personal statements, there's a great deal of data available on what people are searching for, and I hope we'll see more work on what the world looks like if it's in response to a set of search terms rather than the headlines. The quick answer to the question, what's different, is that the headlines of the New York Times and many newspapers is mostly about political, with a few headlines and keys for issues in sports and culture that are on the front page. And the prominent category in searches are practical terms like, where do I find a plumber? And so there's something a little bit mundane about the 30% of searches that deal with very practical needs for objects and services in the home. The percentage of searches that deal with political and government are about 5% of the searches altogether. And that may seem small, but if you think about what people talk about on the average day, maybe that's not so much of a change.
So let me push back on that a little bit, if you don't mind. First is, search engines obviously are very, very important. They're an enabler. Is there research that tells us how much time people spend searching as opposed to the other time that they spend on the web? Maybe that searches, this is sort of the second point, that searches are playing one role, I don't know something, as opposed to newspapers, which play a different role, as opposed to all of the other various sorts of reading and viewing that we do on the web. So there's an assumption here, I think, that the right opposition is between what people search for and what they read in the newspaper. But if they're playing essentially different roles, you may be elevating the role of the search engine and putting into a opposition that is not the natural fit. That is my challenge to you.
It is an appropriate challenge, and you're absolutely correct to point out that that's not a quite parallel analysis, that what people look for, that is basically the websites they go to and their reliance on CNN.com and the headlines that are found there and NewYorkTimes.com. And equally important, and not with a parallel in much of the older media, is the notion of references, that is hypertext linkages that you end up on a site because a lot of other sites refer to that site. So you go there and say, what's going on? What's the hot issue? And that for a more meaningful and appropriate comparison, you'd need to look at what are the headlines on the online sources, and what are the patterns of linkages so that people would end up seeing things either by having found it by a search engine or by some other set of linkages. It raises the question about the long tail, and I conclude with the following striking finding from my colleague Matthew Hinman, and he looks at the relative concentration using some technical economic terms for concentration and finds that the focus on a few dominant corporate sites on the internet is much more concentrated than it is if you look at the comparison to radio, television, and print. And it is a cause, I think, appropriately for concern. Why is it when you've got 8.5 billion places you go, you end up on even a smaller number of corporate-dominated sites than the old media from the newsstand out on Harvard Square?
Thank you very much.
Russell Newman is a professor of media technology at the University of Michigan. You can find out more about Professor Newman, links to his work and recent talks, and to an archive of all Radio's Berkman at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.